Thanks for listening to the Journey Christian Church podcast. We're on a mission to make disciples who love God, love people, and serve the world. Our prayer is that this message encourages you today. And remember, Journey is a place where everybody's welcome, nobody's perfect, and through Jesus, anything is possible.
I'm going to begin a new series today, and I want to begin by telling you a story. A Roman Catholic archbishop described how three mischievous boys decided to play a trick one day on the old local priest who was hearing confessions from his parishioners. The boys took turns going into the confessional and confessing all sorts of terrible sins and crimes to see how the old priest would react. Two of them left in a hurry, but the priest stopped the third one, and as though he was taking him seriously, announced he was going to impose a penance on him. He walked the young lad to the far end of the church building toward a figure of Jesus hanging on the cross. The old priest told the young boy that he was to look Jesus in the face and say three times, "You did all that for me, and I don't give that much," snapping his fingers on the word "that." "You did all that for me, and I don't give that much." The young man did it the first time. He did it the second time, but he couldn't bring himself to do it a third time, but instead started weeping uncontrollably. He left the church a changed person that day, and the reason I know that story is true, concluded the archbishop, is that I was that young man. There is something about the story of Jesus' crucifixion in which all human beings are confronted with the full darkness of humanity and the possibility, through entering the story themselves, of finding a way through to a light that is unextinguishable and a life that is unimaginable. So today we begin a new series of messages titled Cross Examine. And we're going to take these next four Sundays leading up to Easter Sunday, which, by the way, is just a month away, hard to believe. And we're going to explore these questions. Why? What? Who? And so what of Jesus' cross? Today we start with the question, why? Why does the death of a first century Jewish carpenter turned teacher still carry a power that has reached across centuries, continents, countries, cultures, and colors, that seems to go beyond any one articulate explanation and beyond the boundaries of the church or even of explicit Christian faith? One thing we know for sure, whatever it did or did not do to questions about Jesus' existence, his teachings, his motives, or his ultimate purpose, the one thing we know the cross did not do was what it was designed for, to end Jesus' influence. In many ways, it just started it. But to understand why that is, we have to go back to that dark day when no one believed he was anything more than just the latest young leader whose life was brutally snuffed out by an ancient empire. His ragtag movement, comprised mostly of common Galilean fishermen, a few financially independent women, and some secret followers who were afraid of what publicly following him might personally cost them, was over. Jesus' death on the cross was just the sort of thing that Rome did best. The day after Jesus was executed, Caesar was still on his throne, Caiaphas was still the leader of the Jewish nation, and death, as usual, had the last word. Except in this case, it didn't. Why? Jesus' death is central to his story, unlike any other famous person from history. Jesus' death is central to his story, unlike any other famous person from history. If you read the biographies of other famous people, even if their death was a prominent part of their story, like Abraham Lincoln or John F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King Jr., it will only be a small summary statement at the end of their biography. But within a few decades of Jesus' life, four different biographies were written about him that we call the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the story of how Jesus died takes up a disproportionate amount of space, about one third in each of those biographies. Why is that? When we dig deeper into what really happened that fateful Friday that changed the world, we learn that it was a day of mixed motives, odd alliances, secret meetings, cynical PR ploys, political power plays, and explosive emotions. So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to work our way back from late Friday afternoon, when Jesus' crucifixion was complete, through the events that led up to it, to come to see how Jesus would have understood what happened on the way to the cross. Late Friday afternoon, outside the gates of the city of Jerusalem, three crosses are strategically and prominently placed. On the outside crosses hang the bodies of two thieves. The middle cross is empty. Its victim is already dead and has been taken down. But over that vacated middle cross hangs a sign that reads like this: Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. That sign is written in three languages, Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. Somehow, this sign is at the crux of his crucifixion. Many powerful forces and characters are at work, and they combine to crush Jesus. But when we try to understand, it's not clear that the people who think they are in charge on this Friday are really in charge. Everybody in this Friday drama has an agenda. What do they all want? Whose agenda will prevail? The most obvious force is Rome. Jesus ended up being crucified on a Roman cross under Roman authority. So apparently somebody decided that Jesus was a legitimate threat to Rome. But why was he considered a threat? Because he is Jesus Christ. You see, many people mistakenly believe that Christ is Jesus' last name. It's not. That's a title. It comes from the Greek word that means to anoint. Literally, Christ means anointed one or Messiah. There were many wannabe messiahs that arose among the Jews in the first century. The people were waiting for a leader who would lead a revolt against Rome, a leader who will clean up the corruption in the temple and who will lead the nation of Israel into freedom so it can occupy its rightful place as the hope of the world and the envy of the nations. But there were different lines of thinking about what kind of Messiah they were looking for. Some thought he would be the new Moses. Some thought he would be the new David. But all thought his emergence would be the end of Rome. We can read about a few of these wannabe messiahs in the New Testament. Luke tells us about them in the book of Acts that we spent all last month studying. Take a look at chapter 5. He said, some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. He was killed. According to the first century Jewish historian named Josephus, Theudas was called Messiah or Christ. Think Theudas Christ. Ever hear anybody take that name in vain? He claimed he could part the Jordan River, make the walls of Jerusalem fall down like a modern day Joshua. Theudas Christ was eventually captured by the Romans and decapitated in Jerusalem in front of a great crowd. Or as Luke succinctly put it, he was killed. Into him. Luke mentions another Messiah wannabe named Judas the Galilean. Ever heard of Judas Christ? Judas Christ founded a group called the Zealots, according to Josephus. Judas and 2,000 of his followers were crucified. Their crosses were left standing in the Galilean countryside for some time because the Romans wanted to send a message that if anybody else got any bright ideas about trying to get people not to pay their taxes or to disrespect the authority of Rome, then they had plenty more crosses where those came from. You see, death by crucifixion was designed to degrade as well as destroy. Ironically, Judas Christ came to his brutal end when Jesus was a boy. Jesus grew up in the small town of Nazareth, which is in the Galilee region in northern Israel. Jesus most likely would have seen the rotting corpses on crosses. He knew what Rome would do to a man people followed who claimed to be Christ. There were at least 18 Messiah candidates that historians have identified in Jesus' day alone. And they all met the same fate. Jesus Christ was crucified, and yet he was not the kind of military leader, Messiah king, the majority of people were looking for. He did many of the things they expected Messiah to do. He announced a new kingdom. He displayed great power. He spoke amazing words. He claimed great authority. But Jesus deliberately and repeatedly rejected what looked like his destiny. One of Jesus' biographers named John tells us that after Jesus miraculously fed a crowd of thousands with a few fish and loaves of bread, people intended to come and make him king by force. They were thinking, if he could feed thousands with a few scraps of food, imagine what he could do with a few swords and chariots. What did Jesus do in response to this grassroots campaign to coronate him? He headed for the hills alone. He refused to engage or indulge in political revolutions based on hate and fear. He was clearly no military threat to Rome. So why did he end up on a Roman cross? We go back to an earlier encounter on Friday morning that Jesus had with a Roman governor of a volatile region known as Pontius Pilate. Pilate's role is often misunderstood as a series of passive, dismissive, evasive maneuvers. He's painted as a guy who desperately wanted to stay out of the whole Jesus trial ordeal. So it's helpful to look at his role for just a moment. Pilate's job is one big headache. Nobody in his position wanted to end up trying to keep peace in the Middle East, and they still don't, by the way. Pilate was an ambitious man, but he's placed in a no-win predicament. He must keep the Jewish leaders, represented by the chief priest, cooperative, but allow them enough distance that their anti-Roman constituents would still accept their authority. He had to somehow keep a lid on three distinct groups who were each trying to undermine his authority in their own way. First of all, there were the zealots that I mentioned earlier. These are Jewish nationalist extremists. There were the politically minded Pharisees and Sadducees. And then there were the isolationist Essenes. These distinct Jewish factions often disagreed and fought each other, but they were all united in their hatred of Rome, which Pilate stands for. He ruled this region in brutal times, and any leader who's going to survive would have to be a brutal man. Luke's gospel tells us about some people who came one day to tell Jesus that Pilate had killed a group of Jewish pilgrims from Galilee while they were worshiping in the temple in Jerusalem. He even went so far, they told Jesus, as to mix their blood with some of the sacrifices they were making on the altar. The temple was sacred. It was the main structural symbol of Jewish national identity. That also meant it was ground zero for rebellion. It was a dangerous place, and any ruler charged with keeping it under control had to be a dangerous dude himself. Pilate's message to the Jewish temple leaders was as unmistakable as it was unconscionable. Don't mess with me. Another time, Pilate seized money from the Jewish temple treasury to build an aqueduct in Jerusalem. When a group of Jewish leaders protested, Pilate had them executed. Eventually, after Jesus' death, Pilate had so many people executed that the unrest grew unmanageable and Caesar fired him. That was the last history would hear of him. Listen to what an ancient Roman historian named Philo said about Pilate. He said his rule was marked by bribery, insults, robberies, supreme cruelty, executions without trial, and a furious, vindictive temper. So the chief priests bring Jesus to Pilate early on Friday morning. They've carefully thought through the charge they will lay before him. Here it is. We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ a king. Now, you need to understand something right now that might not be obvious at first sight. The chief priest couldn't care less about helping the Roman Caesar squeeze more cash out of Israelite citizens, any more than the American Cancer Society wants to hold fundraisers for tobacco companies. The chief priests do not want to pay more taxes to Caesar. They're just trying to find the most advantageous way to put pressure on Pilate to make him do what they want him to do. This Jesus character is a problem for Rome, Pilate. Caesar won't like it. You better do something about him. And friends, that's how the political power game, fueled by fear, is played. Pilate initially resists the chief priest, not out of any sympathy for Jesus, but because he always resists the chief priest. He never wants to do what they tell him because, you see, by definition, if they get stronger, he gets weaker. When Pilate finds out that Jesus is from Galilee, he tries to pass the buck to Herod, another territorial ruler propped up by Rome, who actually has jurisdiction over Galilee. But Herod won't take the bait, and he quickly sends Jesus back to Pilate. So at this point, Pilate turns to the crowds and he says this, you know, it's the custom at Passover that we release a prisoner. So I'm going to give you a choice. You want me to release Jesus or Barabbas? Mark and Luke both tell us Barabbas had been involved in riots, insurrection movements against Rome. The people would see Barabbas as a freedom fighter and a patriot. So now we understand why the crowd says, give us Barabbas. Barabbas may be dangerous, but the crowds thought at least Barabbas will kill Romans. Better to free a freedom fighter than a passive Messiah. And finally, Jesus' trial before Pilate ends in that famous scene where Pilate symbolically washes his hands of Jesus. Pilate isn't doing this because he has a sensitive conscience or he's worried about what's going to happen to Jesus. He knows the charges against Jesus are trumped up, but Pilate has bigger problems than the fate of the latest wannabe Messiah. He needs to somehow maintain the upper hand over the chief priest and over the temple. He needs to stay in control. So he tells the Jewish leaders, hey, Jesus is your responsibility. But then the chief priest play an unexpected and shocking trump card. Look at John chapter 19, verse 12. They said, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. And Pilate reports to them, or retorts to them, here is your king. And here it comes. We have no king but Caesar. Wow. The Jews hated Caesar. Caesar demanded of his subjects that they repeat, Caesar is Lord. And these Jewish leaders of all people are now aligning themselves with one who considered himself a God. The Jews believed there was only one God, Yahweh. But listen to us, friends, and we know this from our own nation's history. When power is up for grabs, never underestimate what people will do to get it and what they will do to hold on to it. What is it that Caesar wants? Oddly enough, Caesar wants grain. He has a huge ethanol plant just outside of Rome that he ran his chariots on. I'm just kidding about that. Making sure you're still with me. Caesar, listen, needs corn to feed his vast and ever-expanding empire. Rome had grown increasingly dependent on grain from Egypt and the Middle East. Grain was kind of to the Middle East in those days what oil is to the Middle East in our day. So Caesar wants folks under his command to keep the shipments running on time, to keep the population quiet, and get him the food he needs to run his empire. So one of the reasons Jesus died on a purely political level is for corn. for the food needed to fuel Caesar's empire. Pilate could not risk having Caesar think he's soft on anti-Roman anarchist. So he turns to Jesus and he says to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" The intensity and the drama in this moment is hard to overstate. This is the question that had hung over Jesus his entire ministry. And ironically, on any day before this one, all Jesus had to do was one time say, "Yep, that's me. I am the Messiah," and all of Israel, or at least a good chunk of it, would have risen up in arms and died for Jesus. As recently as Palm Sunday, the chance for Jesus to seize control of the crowds lay wide open before him, but he would never claim the title. Now, when there's no crowds around to rally to him, when it's too late to save him, when he's in the hands of the chief priest and Pilate, when there's no chance of an army rising to defend him, Jesus gives a direct and definitive answer to Pilate's question. He says, "Yes, it is as you say. I am the one they've been waiting for. I am Israel's king." Jesus knows what's going to happen to him. Pilate pronounces the sentence that he did not want to pronounce and had tried his best to evade. So if Pilate didn't want this to happen, who or what is making this happen? We back up further to the early hours of Friday before sunrise. Why do the chief priests want Pilate to act to end Jesus' life? Just days before Good Friday, Jesus had raised a man named Lazarus from the dead who'd been dead for 4 days, perhaps his most impressive miracle of all. In John's gospel, we're told that the chief priests and the Pharisees have an emergency meeting right afterward. And here's their response to Jesus' growing fame. They said, "Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." And that was not an idle fear, by the way. That's exactly what happened, in fact, in AD 70. There was one revolt, one wannabe Messiah too many. And the Romans came in and destroyed the temple and virtually obliterated the nation of Israel as a functional nation from off the map. So the priests knew if the unrest grew too strong, Rome would sweep in and crush them. But they also knew that Jesus wasn't a military threat. They understood his teaching and his movement was a threat of another kind. You see, Jesus was claiming that the kingdom of God that everyone had been waiting for was now present on earth. That the love of God, the power of God, the salvation of God was now present and available to them, only it wasn't coming through the temple. And it wouldn't be based on animal sacrifices, as it wasn't rooted in legalistic or nationalistic approach to the law that separated Jews and Gentiles. No, Jesus taught the kingdom of God was demonstrated by himself, by how he lived and how he loved. He was telling everybody that God's presence, God's blessing, God's forgiveness, God's guidance was now available to the world uniquely and exclusively through him. Not only had no one ever done this before, no one had ever thought this before. This was a revolution the likes of which they had never seen before. And in the minds of the temple leaders, this simply cannot stand. So before the hearing before Pilate, there's another one before what is called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was kind of like Israel's Supreme Court. It's made up of chief priests and Pharisees and Sadducees. They have arrested Jesus very early on Friday morning, and they have their own little trial before they take Jesus to Pilate. All this is done before daybreak so it can be secret. Because the chief priests have a very delicate task in front of them. You see, they have to get the crowds to hate Jesus, and they have to get Rome and Pilate to crucify Jesus. Of course, the quickest way to get Pilate to crucify Jesus was to tell him Jesus is a threat to Roman Caesar. So throw in a little bit, he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, and that'll do it. But if they tell the crowds that, the crowds will actually rally to Jesus. The Israelite people would love not to pay taxes to Rome. So they got to come up with some other bogus charges. So they came up with two charges. They charged Jesus with blasphemy, so the crowds will hate him, and they charged Jesus with treason, so Pilate will kill him. This is a very challenging task for them. In fact, they couldn't get it done at this trial. The Gospel of Mark records this for us. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Jesus makes no attempt to correct their false charges. He stands in silence as they mock him. But when they ask him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus makes this one statement. He says, "I am." "I am" is the same word for Yahweh, for the holy and unique name of God in the Old Testament. In essence, Jesus was saying, "I am God." And then he says, "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." He was not saying here, "You're one day going to see my body float down out of the sky." He was using a well-known image from the prophetic writings of Daniel to say, "You are now seeing God present and at work uniquely in me. I am the Son of God. I am the Son of Man. I am the God-man." Jesus was writing his own death warrant, announcing his own death sentence. He literally handed them what they could not get from all of their false witnesses. Jesus did their work for them. Why? Why would he do that? We got to back up one final time. Before the cross, before the meeting with Pilate, before this sham of a night court with the Sanhedrin, to a place called Gethsemane. The story of the human race, according to the Bible, begins in a garden with a man named Adam, and the story of the one who later would be called a second Adam ends in a garden. Max Lucado writes, "The Bible is the story of two gardens, Eden and Gethsemane. In the first, Adam took a fall. In the second, Jesus took a stand. In the first, God sought Adam. In the second, Jesus sought God. In Eden, Satan led Adam to a tree that led to his death. From Gethsemane, Jesus went to a tree that led to our life." When Jesus was in the garden, he still had many options. Listen, he could fight like the zealots. He was young. He had charisma. The crowds would follow him to death. He could do that. He could withdraw like the Essenes. He could go into the desert and start a safe little self-contained community for his disciples that would be a threat to no one. Many would follow him. He could collaborate with the chief priest. Imagine what reform Jesus might bring if he had the temple as the platform for his teaching. He could try to cut a deal with Pilate. Imagine influence in the Roman Empire from the inside. What might that do for the world? He could call on his God to deliver him. He could ask to be spared. He could ask for legions of angels. Maybe one more miracle would rally everybody to his side. That thought had to at least cross his mind. But Jesus chose none of those options. Setting aside questions about his divinity and identity, this is what Jesus did. This lone, deserted, vulnerable man decided, "I know what I must do. I will not fight. I will not run. I will not deal. I will not dazzle. I will die." And so he prayed in the garden, "Father, if it is possible for this cup to pass from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." Jesus came to believe that the messianic calling was not to conquer other people, but to die for them. So he did. Put aside theories, theology, for just a moment. Jesus knew that rebels were routinely killed by Rome. If he did not die, a rebel named Barabbas would. Jesus died on a cross in place of Barabbas. Jesus knows that the crowds, even now, are just waiting for a word from him to march against the Romans. Many Roman soldiers were just boys from nearby Syria working for the Roman government. But Jesus never gives that revolutionary word. He goes to the cross and he dies, and a whole legion of Roman soldiers would live. Jesus knows if he flees, his disciples will be rounded up and executed. That had happened to every other wannabe Messiah, and it would happen to them. His disciples know that's how Rome operates, and they fled in terror from the one they loved and left everything to follow. Jesus dies, and for a while at least, his disciples are saved, preserving their lives so something they don't even understand yet can be formed and nurtured and delivered through them. Jesus knows what the chief priest knew. that if he were to incite a riot, Rome would come down and destroy Jerusalem. So he dies and saves Jerusalem in the process. He dies for all those people who are so disappointed in him, who didn't understand him, who cried out in frustration and pain that he should be crucified. He willingly lays down his life for a group of people who by and large rejected him. That can buy a little more time. That can buy a little more space. Enough space and enough time that a little community of his followers can be formed out of his sacrificial love that can change the world. As a simple historical reality, it was sin, human darkness, and every other person involved that put Jesus on the cross. But he believed that through love, the cross could somehow become not just a symbol of sin and death, but a symbol of something even more powerful, of redemptive love. Out of his remarkable brilliance, his breathtaking courage, his inexplicable love, Jesus sized up a situation that defeated every human attempt at correction. He identified exactly what would be needed to bring redemption. It would cost him his life. And friends, 2,000 years later, Jesus' death is the most important and most remembered death in the history of the world. Jesus outlasted, he outmaneuvered, he outthought every group, every power, but mostly Jesus just outloved everybody. For Jesus in the garden had one agenda that superseded the agendas of all others, love. On Friday, Jesus died for love. He said it was his choice. It wasn't Pilate's choice. It wasn't Herod's. It wasn't Caesar's. It wasn't the chief priest. It wasn't the crowds, and it certainly wasn't his disciples. He said, I lay down my life for the sheep. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. And because he did, the cross has become the most widely recognized symbol in the world. It marks more graves, graces more pieces of jewelry, is tattooed on more bodies, sets atop more buildings than any other design. The making of the sign of the cross is known from basilicas to baseball diamonds. Finding a lasting logo has become big business, but no country or corporation or cause has ever produced such an enduring and widespread image. And listen, it's so easy for us to forget what a strange symbol it is to be so widely known and cherished. The cross was the most excruciating, most humiliating means of execution available to Rome. Imagine choosing an electric chair to hang around your neck, or a hangman's noose, or a guillotine as an icon for anything. Jesus changed the cross from the symbol of a human empire's power to take life into a symbol of the suffering love of God to give life. It was changed from an expression of ultimate threat into an expression of ultimate hope. It came, in a sense, to express the exact opposite of its original purpose, that the power of embraced sacrifice is greater than the power of political coercion. How did this happen? Jesus chose it. He chose to die on it. And after Friday, neither the cross nor the world would stay the same. And I believe that when we truly understand why he went to the cross, we can't stay the same either. So this month, as we take this up-close look at Jesus on a cross, I challenge you to do so and say, I don't care that much. I think you do. And I think you should. Someone has said believing Jesus died is a fact of history. Believing Jesus died for me is the first step to salvation. Believing Jesus died, it's a fact of history, but believing Jesus died for me is the first step of salvation. Would you bow your heads with me here at Apopka, at Lake County, online? Father, the only thing I can say right now is what Isaac Watts wrote so many years ago, when I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died. My richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride. Father, forbid it that we would ever boast in anything except the cross of Jesus our Lord, through whom I was crucified to the world and the world was crucified to me. Father, help us lift up the cross of Jesus, because you said, when I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. And so we lift up the cross of Jesus today in this month. I pray you'll draw people in Apopka and Lake County and online from everywhere to yourself, Jesus. We ask in your name. Amen.
If you like this podcast, we post a new message every week. So make sure to click that follow button and share it with your friends. Remember, Journey is a place where everybody's welcome. Nobody's perfect. And through Jesus, anything is possible.